Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Svarm Chatter podcast. For this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Professor David Berger, who is the Ruth and I. Lewis Gordon Distinguished Professor of Jewish History at the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies at Yeshiva University, and formerly the Dean of the Bernard Revel Graduate School. So thank you. And we'll be discussing Christian-Jewish polemic and Professor Berger's works and writings on that as well. So thank you very much, Professor Berger, for joining me.
You're very welcome.
So why don't we start out, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
Let me see, how far back do you want me to go? I was born in Brownsville, what used to be a Jewish neighborhood in Brooklyn. I went, despite the fact that I lived in Brownsville, to the Yeshiva Flatbush, both in elementary school and in high school. And from there, I went to Yeshiva College to the Yeshiva division, undergraduate division that many Yeshiva College students went to. I majored in Greek and Latin, actually. With a famous professor within restricted circles, Louis Feldman, who is one of the world's greatest experts on Josephus, maybe the world's greatest expert on Josephus, and a famously demanding professor. When I graduated from college, I went to simultaneously. To the Smicha program at YU, where I studied primarily with Rav Soloveitchik, with the Rav, and to Columbia Graduate School in Jewish History, where I studied for the first 2 years briefly with the already technically retired Salo Baron, one of the world's greatest Jewish historians of the 20th century, primarily with Gerson Cohen, who later became the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary. Beyond that, I taught for two academic years, from 68, 69, and 69, 70. In Yeshiva College, I received my PhD in 70. I moved my full-time job to Brooklyn College in the academic year 70-71, but I taught as an adjunct there in 69-70. And I remained there for a very long time, well over 30 years, where I taught there and in the City University Graduate Center. Though I also taught part-time in the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Yeshiva University throughout that entire period. I started that in 1975 until I retired from CUNY in 2007 to move full-time to the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Yeshiva. As I said, during that entire period, I taught in the Rebel Graduate School as a visiting professor, except for three semesters. One of which I taught my extra course at Yale, and two of which I taught my extra course at Harvard. And I had one sabbatical year. In 2007, I officially retired from CUNY, came full time to Yeshiva. I thought as a professor with an easier schedule and fewer students, within a year I was, let us say, persuaded to do something I'd never done my whole career, and that is accept a high administrative position, which I never wanted to do. But I now found myself in a university which I cared about for reasons that went beyond the fact that it was my employer. I was convinced that I needed to do this. And so for the last 12 years until this past July, I was the dean of the Bernard Revel Graduate School, as well as teaching one course there. And this year I decided to move to being a mere professor again.
Okay. So, like I mentioned, we'll be discussing Christian-Jewish polemic, and I believe the part that you didn't mention is you actually, way back when, worked on your PhD on the Sefer Nitzachon, which is about Christian-Jewish polemic. So we'll get more into that a little bit later. But how is that something that you decided to get into and subsequently work over the years on this topic?
Okay, that's an interesting question. I have to sort of figure out the elements that went into it. First of all, it so happens my father was a Jewish book dealer, an editor at the Hadar, which was a Hebrew journal, and a scholar, but not in any academic context. He was pretty much self-taught, so I had a house full of books when I was growing up. And one of the books that somehow caught my attention and my great interest was the Ramban's Disputation. So I was sort of interested in this subject from my high school years, from having read the so-called Vikuach HaRamban at home. Then when I was in college, as I said, I majored in classics and Greek and Latin, but that was because I knew I was interested in Jewish history and thought that I would need to know those languages. And in my senior year of college, a visiting professor came to Yeshiva, whose full-time job was at Columbia. His name was Norman Cantor. He wrote a standard textbook on medieval history, and we had to do papers. And I decided, I can't tell you why this happened. I think probably I wanted to show off that I knew Latin. So I did a paper on an anti-Jewish polemical work written by Peter Damian, who was a saint, who was made a saint, a medieval figure. And actually came up with a chidush, as they say in Hebrew. I came up with a discovery about one of the sources of this work, and I wrote a paper on it, a long paper on it. Norman Cantor marked the papers while giving the final exam. He leafed through them. It looked like, and he wrote on this paper the following. I still remember this. It said, he gave it an A+, and he said, merits publication. Still, I think you miss the point, or the main point. That's because I actually criticized something that he had said in his textbook. But in any event, he was then instrumental in, he was on the admissions committee in Columbia Graduate School. And I think he played a significant role in my getting in with a major scholarship. But I wrote that paper, and that paper sort of got me, all the more interested in this field. And that was a serious paper. I actually reprinted it in a collection of my essays. It was written when I was still in college. Then in graduate school, I wrote my master's thesis on the Ramban, but not having to do with the disputation, having to do with his attitude towards secular learning and his role in the Maimonidean controversy. But then I had to pick a dissertation topic. And a friend of mine, actually, whose name I'll mention, it was Shimon or Sidney Hook, had come across a recently reprinted soft cover version of the Sefer Nitzachon Yashan that had been reprinted by Akademon, which developed materials for courses at the Hebrew University. And there was an important Hebrew University professor who actually used this text for his course. So they reprinted the 1681 printing of this work. And this friend of mine gave it to me. And I decided that I should write my dissertation on this subject. So that's a probably longer answer than you wanted to explain how I got into this.
Nah, it's fascinating. Very, very interesting. So Okay, so I think we should start by, before we get into discussing your work that you've done, just, I think, give a little bit of a brief overview of somewhat of what polemic means and what exactly we're discussing over here.
Okay, so I would say that we are discussing something that has a has multiple dimensions in terms of how it was expressed. Jewish-Christian polemic means, straightforwardly, debates, disagreements, disputations between Jews and Christians about the respective validity of their religions. But it takes, as I said, various forms. Sometimes one finds these expressions of disagreement and argument in works of biblical interpretation, in works of philosophy, that is, works that are not devoted to this subject, but that contain material, sometimes a great deal of material, in this genre. Let's say in a biblical commentary, what does a particularly difficult or controversial verse means when God says, "Let us make man in our image"? Sa'adam b'tzalmeinu. Why is that a plural verb? And b'tzalmeinu is also a plural. And of course, Christians said what they said, and Jews, said what they said. So there, you can have in a Jewish commentary polemical material. Then there are written polemical works, that is, books written by Jews and by Christians to refute the other religion and defend their own. There is a substantial literature of that sort. And finally, there are the public formal disputations that were arranged in the case of Jews without their active initiative, of which some of the most famous are the Ramban's disputation in Barcelona in 1263, the earlier disputation that Jews called the disputation of Rabbi Yechiel of Paris in 1240, which was really a trial of the Talmud, the Tortosa disputation in the early 15th century, and a few more, not a lot of those, but a few more. So, and I should just say one other thing, and that is that I actually wrote an article arguing that even on the streets of Europe in the Middle Ages, there were actually Jews who initiated disputations with Christians in conversation. But even in cases where the Jews didn't initiate it and the Christians initiated it, that's another type of disputation. And sometimes we have some records of these oral disputations that are not formally organized.
Now, how unique are those, the two disputations? I think the Ramban's is fairly famous, and the other one, the Bichil of Paris in 1240. Those were both of those, we have written accounts of the Ramban from himself, and the Bichil of Paris in 1240 we have also as well. How unique are those, that they actually were written up, versus were there other disputations that happened that that also had written, accounts of them?
There were some others, not a lot. As I mentioned, the disputation at Tortosa, which happened in Spain in 1413 and 14, if I have the dates right. If not, it's a year off. It lasted, as I have sometimes told classes, for about a year and a half with coffee breaks. This was formally organized by the church to try to persuade the Jews to convert. Jews were working, unlike Barcelona, in an atmosphere of intimidation. The participants were not in their homes. I'll give you one example that tells you something about the atmosphere. Let me say that with Tortosa, we don't have a formal written version by Jews, but we have some in a book called Shevet Yehuda, where he has excerpts of what happened, and there's a Latin version. just to give you some sense of the fear that was felt, though sometimes Jews, you know, forgot about that fear and were reminded of it. There is a dispute, a debate in, or is an exchange in the Ramban's disputation, where the Christian, the convert to Christianity, was his who was his antagonist, cited a midrash that the Messiah was born on the day of the destruction of the temple, which he said proves that the Messiah has already come. The Ramban said that he doesn't believe this midrash, that you don't have to believe every midrash. And besides, there are conflicting midrashim, so he's certainly entitled to affirm those. But he will say that he believes it because it proves that Jesus is not the Messiah, because he wasn't born on the day of the destruction of the temple. When he was asked if the Messiah was born on the day of the destruction of the temple, and you say he hasn't come yet. He was born, but he hasn't come yet, according to this Gemara, or this Midrash, rather. So the question is, what do you mean he hasn't come yet? So how old is he? The Ramban said that we have to think of how old Mesushelach was, and over 900 years. And since the Messiah is, when the Messiah comes, death will, I have to be very careful how to say this because it's not quite the Ramban's position generally, but that, you know, the end of death will be sort of, let's say, announced or begun or prefigured. So it could well be that the Messiah will, in fact, not die. But even if he won't, we saw that Mesushelach lived over 900 years, so the Mashiach could live that long, even though the Ramban had said he doesn't really believe this. This was raised at Tortosa, and one of the Jews, you know, gave this answer. You know, it's a complex answer, but when he said that the Messiah could be that old, one of the Christians there challenged this as completely irrational. And so the Jew said to him, you know what? You Christians believe so many irrational things that why do you begrudge us that we should believe one irrational thing? So it was a good comeback. But in the Jewish account that we have, we are told that when the Jewish disputants went back to their motel that night, the others, you know, angrily berated the rabbi who had said this and said to him, you know, did you forget where you are? You know, you're sitting here in a place where we are endangered and you have to watch what you say. So, you know, that's an example of a disputation that took place under very difficult conditions.
I want to get to something that you mentioned there, which you said you wanted to carefully say their man's position. It's not usually his position. So that's something that I think we should discuss, is that either disputation or overall polemical works like Sefer Nitzachon, et cetera, that we'll get to, is how reliable or accurate, I don't know the best way to say this, are that they are the position of the authors, or is it something that they were just saying in like a polemical form, so to speak?
Okay, this is a very good question indeed. There are different views among scholars. Some consider that you simply have to assume that any statement that seems to some degree inconsistent with the worldview or the interpretive approach of the Jewish disputant is not sincere, and was said just for the sake of the debate. There's no doubt that that sometimes Jews did do such things, but my own inclination is to assume that is that the default position that I should take is that the statement is sincere, because you know Jews, after all, had a motivation to internalize anti-Christian interpretations and positions. And so they are, for the most part, likely to be saying things that they believe. One of the most famous examples of, I can give you a famous example from each of the two major 13th century disputations. In the case of Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, he had to deal with the accusation that Jesus is the subject of extremely nasty and, from a Christian perspective, blasphemous statements in rabbinic literature. And as well as with the affirmation that rabbinic literature contains discriminatory laws against Gentiles, which would include Christians. And with respect to these two accusations, Rabbi Yechiel said, A, the nasty things one finds in the Talmud about Jesus are about a different Yeshu. And he brought evidence that there's one Talmudic passage that Yeshu was a student of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Prachya, who lived too early to have been the teacher of the Christian Jesus. Did he mean that seriously, that there were two Jesuses? Or was he saying this to deflect the Christian accusation that the Talmud is a blasphemous work? Another example in that disputation is when it came to discriminatory laws, he said that these apply to ancient pagans, but not to Christians. And he brought proof of this, that we do business with Christians on their holidays, when according to the Mishnah, you're not supposed to do this. According to the Talmud, you're not supposed to do this. And he said, this is a very striking argument, you Christians know that we die for our faith. So don't tell me that we do business with you because we need it to make a living. We die for our faith. So it must mean that I am being sincere when I say that these laws don't apply to you. But these are two examples from the Paris disputation, where you can see why people, both regular Jews and academic scholars, have suspected that these statements were not said sincerely. In the case of the Ramban's disputation, I've already mentioned this point without dwelling on this aspect of it. Namely, he said that you don't have to believe Midrashim. Did he really mean that? And about this, there is a significant scholarly debate. And there is also debates within traditional Jewish sources that are not academic.
Right. So we'll get more into where you mentioned the Gemara, how they did business together and all that, a lot of stuff that comes with Sechta Vedazar. We'll get a little bit more into that in a little bit. But what a similar related question, I guess, which is worth asking is, I think, is that you mentioned Shevi Yehuda, which is famously has a lot of stories, and you mentioned the account that we have of the disputation in 1240 of Yechiel of Paris. I mean, how historically reliable are those accounts as well? Or is it something that also that they wrote down the accounts, the Jews, you know, in a way to use it as a kind of almost as a kind of like safer, as a polemic, you know, as a guide for going forward? Or are they historically factually, you know, accurate?
Okay, so here too, as you no doubt know, because you're asking this question, we're dealing with academic disagreements. I'll start just briefly with the Paris disputation. It's pretty clear that the accusations leveled by the Christian, whose name was Nicholas Donin, was also an apostate, a convert to Christianity from Judaism, do reflect the arguments that he made. I mean, we know this. First of all, there's a document that he prepared. Jews certainly weren't going to make up these assertions about all the terrible things in the Talmud. There's no question that the accusations that were leveled are authentic, pretty much authentic. The question is, when you have responses by Rabbi Yechiel, are they somehow improved, in some cases maybe invented in the written version? look, the written versions of these the Jewish and Christian versions are certainly colored by the biases of their authors. And anybody who writes an account of a disputation like this and is an engaged observer is going to emphasize the effectiveness of the arguments that his side made. You know before you even look at this that there's going to be some degree of a coloring in favor of the position of the author. But on the whole, I don't think there's much question that the arguments as well as the responses are pretty much a reflection of the arguments that are actually made. Also, you don't finish reading the Hebrew version of the dispute with the sense that Rabbi Yechiel won a crushing victory. This was a very difficult situation that he found himself in. But then we go to Barcelona, where there's a whole scholarly literature about this in which I've participated. And it goes back more than a century. There's a Latin version in which the Christians win this debate. And, the Ramban, Nebuch gives these unconvincing responses. And we have Ramban's own version in which he does extremely well. And back in the late 19th century, a Christian scholar argued for preferring the Latin version. And a Jewish scholar responded with an article still in the very late 19th century. Then in the 20th century, Yitzhak Ber, the great historian of Jews in medieval Spain, wrote an article entitled "Le Vikoret Havikuchim Shel Rabbi Yechiel MiParis VaRamban," and he presented what he considered a more balanced picture. More recently, Robert Chazen of NYU was a great medievalist, Jewish medievalist, wrote an article called Barcelona and Beyond, in which he analyzed the Vikuach, and he said something that I think is a kind of telling way of putting it. He said when people watch presidential debates and one is a vigorous supporter of candidate A and the other is a vigorous supporter of candidate B, and you ask them, how did your candidate do? You will get different answers. Not because they are dishonest, but because that's how they see things. They see it through the prism of their own biases. That much I think is true. However, the specific arguments against the veracity of the Ramban's version strike me as unpersuasive. I wrote an article-length review of Chazen's book, said very nice things about parts of it, but said that I think that the arguments against the validity or against the accuracy of certain things he says are refuted by some historical facts that we know. For example, the Ramban tells us that the king who was present at the debate, James I of Aragon, gave the Ramban a monetary reward for his performance and said, I have never seen anyone who was wrong argue his case as well as you did. And we actually have evidence that he did give him this award, which is remarkable. We should actually have such evidence. In addition, when the church authorities, after the Ramban wrote his version of what happened, leveled a complaint against him with the king, saying that he has to be punished for what he wrote. The Ramban defended himself by saying, to the king, but you gave me the right to free expression during this debate. And the king pretty much accepted this argument. So you have to ask yourself, if the disputation in the Ramban's version is inaccurate in important ways, what kind of a defense was this? You gave me freedom of expression during the debate. Very nice. But then you wrote a version that is not accurate. So what good does the freedom of expression you were granted during the debate do if, with respect to your written version, which doesn't reflect what you said during the debate, or at least the objectionable parts don't reflect what you said during the debate? That doesn't make any sense. And I said that this is reminiscent of the famous line about the ultimate example of chutzpah, where someone who killed his father throws himself at the mercy of the court on the grounds that he's an orphan. But the difference is that nobody ever said that the judge accepted the argument. Here, the king actually accepted this remarkably chutzpahdik argument that you gave me freedom of expression, and so I should be protected for the lies that I wrote in the written version. That's ludicrous. So I think that we actually have some powerful reason to think that the things that the Ramban said and wrote in his version of the debate that aroused the ire of church figures, and which led many scholars to say that it's just unreasonable that he would have said such things, such as, he told the king that when the Messiah comes, there should be universal peace. That would cause you trouble because you have all of these soldiers who fight for you. What would they do if the Messiah had already come? And people just assumed he couldn't have said that. I argued that I thought he could have. So that's a long answer to your question about the accuracy of these debates. Obviously, each one has to be examined independently on its own merits.
Well, that's a lot about the obviously it's written accounts, but a lot about disputations. So about purely polemical works, which are so first of all, discuss some famous ones. There's the Sefer Nitzach and Yoshen, which you published a critical edition in Hebrew and English, so we should discuss that. And then there's also the newer Sefer Nitzachim, which before we started recording, I told you everyone knows of Rabbi Yom Tov Lipman Milhausen's, which obviously not everyone knows, but it's somewhat, I guess, more famous than the Sefer Nitzachim Yoshen, I guess is a better way to put it. Those polemical works, talk a little bit about them and other famous, just purely polemical works, not, you know, history of disputations or that kind of thing.
Could you clarify what you're asking? What exactly are you asking me?
What other polemical works are there besides the two Sefer Nitzachim?
Oh, okay.
That's what I mean. And talk about them a little bit, the Sefer Nitzachim. We'll get a little bit more into them as well after.
Okay. So the answer is there are a lot. It's not a tremendous genre, but there are a significant number of works. I'll give you some examples. The earliest work of this sort is called the Book of Nestor HaKomer. That goes back to the Middle East in the early Middle Ages. When you get to the Middle Ages proper, in around 1170, you have both the Sefer HaBrit of Yosef Kimchi, the father of the Radak, and Sefer Melchamot Hashem of Yaakov ben Uvain, written in the south of France. You have the public disputations, of course, that I mentioned in the 13th century. There is a book by Meir ben Shimon of Narbonne, who was also a Rishon as a halachist or a Talmudist, called Milchemet Mitzvah, which has never been published in its entirety in the middle of the 13th century. A book called Sefer Yosef HaMekaneh, that was written in northern France in the 1260s, probably. The Sefer Nitzachon Yashan, which is the book that I edited that was probably compiled in Germany in the late 13th or maybe very early 14th century, which in large measure is an anthology. Although it's more than that. It's clear that the author, you know, revised certain things, added certain arguments, but much of it is an anthology of earlier Ashkenazic polemic, some of which survives in manuscript, and which I didn't mention. That is a book that it's a long book, it's structured first in the order of the Tanakh, and dealing with verses that Christians cite to prove their religion, the fact that it's a long, that this part is a very long part, tells you that there were a lot of such verses. Then it continues with a critique of both the New Testament and of Christianity in general. There's much to say about the critique of the New Testament, which in some respects is parallel to the Christian critique of the Talmud. I don't know how much you want me to talk about that, but Jews cited passages of the New Testament that from their perspective made no sense or contradicted one another. So that's a critique of the New Testament. But they also use the New Testament to demonstrate that Jesus observed the Torah and that therefore Christians ought to as well. Then after that, there are probably the most important polemical work written in late medieval Spain is Profiat or Prophet Duran's Sefer Klimat HaGoyim, or Shame of the Gentiles, which is the most sophisticated Jewish polemical work in dealing with the New Testament and other such issues. Then we go into the 16th century in Italy, where you have some such books written. In the early modern period, you have what became, I think, the most used and most well-known anti-Christian polemical work. It's a systematic work. The reason it is so interesting, beyond its intrinsic value, is that it was written by a Karaite. It's called Chizuk Emunah, Strengthening of the Faith, by Isaac of Troki. And it became extremely popular among Rabbinite Jews, deservedly so. It's very well done. In some Rabbinite versions, there were things stuck in from the Talmud and stuff like that in order to make it more palatable for Rabbinite readers. Then I suppose I should say, as a matter of personal privilege, that in 1978 or so, I wrote a little book with Michael Wishegrad, who was an Orthodox Jewish philosopher with a great interest in Christianity and about whom I could talk at length, but not now. We were asked by the Anti-Missionary Task Force of the Jewish Community Relations Council of New York to write a short work, a booklet of to deal with Jews for Jesus or similar groups, to provide responses. We wrote this little booklet, called Jews and, quote, Jewish Christianity, unquote. I can say that I take considerable satisfaction in the fact that I know of a few cases where a person really was saved from apostasy by this book. I think his title is executive director of Jews for Judaism in Toronto, which is an anti-missionary organization that does good work, told me that he himself, had been part of a Jewish Christian group, and that this book was a primary influence in saving him from apostasy, and now he's engaged in anti-missionary work. So I do take a kind of personal satisfaction in this particular polemical work.
Wow, amazing. Yeah, it's a small booklet. I've seen it.
It's available, by the way, and the entire text is available on the website of Jews for Judaism in Toronto. And you can get it just by doing a Google search of Jews and Jewish Christianity.
Okay. So one that I mentioned that you didn't discuss was the second Sefer Nitzachim by said Rav Yom Tov Libman in the Millhouse. How does that relate to the first Sefer Nitzachim? Does it? Is it related in any way?
No. I have to say that when I first read the later Sefer Nitzachim, I was really taken aback by the fact that it's not at all a traditional anti-Christian polemic. It has much other material. The author was a person of broad interest for an Ashkenazi Jew in the late Middle Ages. He had a broad philosophical interest of sorts. If you turn enough pages, you will find anti-Christian arguments. But it's a much more complex book than the Nitzachim Yashan.
Okay, so I think we should talk a little bit about the Nitzachon Yashan, like which one you edited. So discuss a little bit in the beginning how you came to edit it, but then you eventually worked on it and you published it as a book with Hebrew and English. So, who wrote it? I don't think, and it's talk about that. And talk a little bit how, systematically, I mean, I guess you mentioned that it goes through Tanakh, but a little bit more than that, maybe.
Okay. So I can answer the first question of who wrote it succinctly. I don't know. For our purposes, it's an anonymous work. And as I said, it's in significant measure an anthology of Ashkenazic polemic in the 12th and 13th centuries. It's not a philosophically sophisticated work, which is true of Ashkenazic polemic in general, although not of Southern French works that like Milchamot Hashem of Jacob and Reuven, which is quite sophisticated philosophically. But the northern material is not, and that's a discussion for another time. So that arguments against the Trinity and the Incarnation tend to be, kind of very, how should I put it, simple and one might say unsophisticated, but it doesn't mean that they're not effective. The knowledge of Christian doctrine is sometimes faulty and but interesting, so that, near the very beginning of the book, the reader is asked, what would happen if the father says that there should be plenty and the son decides that there should be a famine? What's going to happen? And they're not really, good Christian theology. That can't happen if you understand the Christian theology well. There is a certain sense in this and in other Jewish works that the Trinity is basically tritheism. It's sort of almost a belief in three gods rather than a triune God. In terms of its of the biblical material, it's done, I think, for the most part in a quite effective fashion, though not all the arguments will appeal to us as convincing. But plenty of them are. The book is also aggressive, sometimes nasty and satirical. I hesitate to some degree to give you an example, but since we just read Parshat Vayechi, I'm going to give in to my evil inclination and give you an example that's really not very nice. The Christians, he says, the author says, tell us that when it says Vayishtachu Yisrael al Rosh HaMita, that Yaakov bowed at the head of the bed, that this means, you know, you should not read it mitah or bed. You should read it mateh or staff. And indeed, you have such a reading in the Septuagint and in the New Testament that he bowed at the head of the staff or leaning at the on the staff. And the staff means the cross. So Yaakov bowed down to the cross. So the author of the Nitzachon Yashan says the following. He says, you should answer him, ki ivalto, in accordance with his perversity, and say, you're right. Yaakov became confused because he was so ill. And in a moment of confusion, he bowed down to the cross. But he then recovered. And once he became clear-headed, he wanted to signal that he had made a terrible mistake by doing that. And therefore it says, Vayishtachu Yisrael, therefore it says, Vayeshev al hamita, which you should also read as mateh. He took the cross and he sat on it. And the place that where you sit is even described in particularly graphic language that I will not repeat here. But that's an example of quite a few such examples of very sharp and aggressive comments. Did a Jew actually say this to a Christian in debate? In this particular case, I doubt it. Although I do think that certain things that would surprise us were said. But I'm not going to go as far as to say that this was said. And then, as I said, there is a thorough critique of New Testament with both approaches that I mentioned earlier, namely arguing that it's full of errors and also arguing that Jesus behaved in ways that showed that he didn't agree with Christian doctrine, that he denied that he was God, and that he urged observing the Torah. And there's obviously some other material as well.
And I believe your published edition, like I said, has Hebrew and English in two different sections. And also it was based on used manuscript, Kisviyadis. I think that's what it says in old printing. Also, it was published by Jason Aronson, but I believe, I mean, I bought a copy used that is pretty, I guess, available used if anyone wants to buy one, right?
I mean, it can be bought online. It's part of a series of works that the American Historical Association chose to be available through their website. I don't know if it's available normally through a kind of open access procedure, but it is available if you look hard enough. They'll send it, they'll print it out for you, basically. It's a kind of on print-on-demand arrangement.
Right. So I think something that we should just, discuss here is how relevant today still are these topics? Obviously, you did mention you wrote that little booklet and it still is relevant in certain ways. So, but how relevant, especially are the older, Rishonim, these older polemical works today?
Well, look, the Christianity in its fundamentalist version hasn't changed that much. So that the groups that are involved in trying to missionize Jews are generally very traditionalist in their beliefs regarding Christianity. So that in that sense, the old arguments remain relevant. In that booklet that we wrote, we didn't emphasize the Jewish arguments of the irrationality of Christian belief. This is one of the most polite anti-Christian polemics ever written. But we did make use of the idea. I mean, I wrote the chapter on that was called Proofs and Quotation Marks of Christianity in the Hebrew Bible. And the arguments that I made there, although I added some things, from my own perspective, are in significant measure taken from the medieval Jewish polemical works. So when you're dealing with this narrow area of actual anti-Christian polemic or apologetics or defense, then from that perspective, many of the old arguments are still relevant. To some degree, I'll give you an example of adding the kind of argument that you don't find generally in medieval polemical works because they don't have a strong sense of historical criticism. The Christian polemicists in the Middle Ages and Jews for Jesus types today cite verses that reflect or that supposedly are fulfilled in the life and career of Jesus. So I'll give you some examples and I'll tell you what I mean by dealing with them from a historical critical perspective. The Micha Hey Aleph reads, and you, Beit Lechem Ephrata, from you will emerge for me a ruler in Israel whose origins are from the far past, from days of yore. V'ata, I'll say it in Ashkenazi, V'ata Beit Lechem Ephrata, Mimcha Li Yetzei Moshe B'Yisrael, U'motze Osav Mikedem Mimei Olam. So a Christian said that this proves that Jesus is the Messiah because he was born in Bethlehem and also proves that he is eternal because his origins are from, you know, Mikedem, from all the way back. All right. So then there are two examples of things that happened allegedly at the crucifixion scene, which are referred to specifically in the Tanakh. That people divided up the clothing of the psalmist who was being attacked. This is Psalm 22, that is a crucifixion psalm according to Christians, because it begins, "Keli Keli Lama Asaftani," my Lord, why have you forsaken me? Which was said by Jesus on the cross. And finally, my final example that also deals with the crucifixion is that in Isaiah 53, one of the most important biblical texts that Christians cited and cite to this day, the servant of the Lord, who they say is Jesus, is silent before his accusers. Okay, so there is an issue here that I raised in a footnote and carefully. I didn't want to make this book an attack on Christianity per se. I said the following. We have to ask ourselves or raise the possibility of circular reasoning in these Christian arguments. For example, there was strong reason to believe that Jesus was not born in Bethlehem. I can't go into that now. Many scholars, including Christian scholars, don't think he was born in Bethlehem. Rather, he was placed in Bethlehem because of this verse in Micha. So it's not that this verse in Micha remarkably prophesies Jesus' birth in Bethlehem, but the assertion that he was born in Bethlehem is there because of this verse in Micha. And similarly, the assertions in the gospel narrative that Jesus' clothes were divided up by Roman soldiers and that he was silent before his accusers are very likely to result from a reading of Isaiah 53 as a description of the crucifixion. So the details were put in to correspond to the biblical verse. So that to say that the biblical verse proves that Jesus is a prophecy of Jesus's experience is very problematic and raises the question of circularity. I did not add in that footnote what a friend of mine once said when I told him this. He said, "This is like the remarkable ability of the New York Times to prophesy what will appear in the Yiddish paper 3 days later."
Very good. So I think something though that's similar is that so why would this be, why would something just speak to, I guess I'm sure that listeners listening saying, okay, I understand that, but why is it relevant to me? Why would such a topic be relevant to your quote unquote regular average from person today to read? Why is this a topic that would be, you know, something that's relevant to them?
Okay, so first of all, you know, the most obvious answer is that if they should ever come into contact with Christian missionary activity or with a Jew who's been affected by them, then this is directly and obviously very important. On the other hand, there is a whole other Jewish-Christian interaction that goes on nowadays in the context of Jewish-Christian dialogue, in which I've been pretty actively involved, although there are certain guidelines that were issued by Rav Soloveitchik about theological dialogue that for the most part, Orthodox people involved in this matter observe or attempt to observe. It's how you apply it is complicated, but in any case, this is an important area of contemporary Jewish-Christian interaction. How to deal with Christianity in this much more friendly environment is a difficult and complex question. And in my experience, knowing what Jews have had to say about Christianity through the ages has been helpful in setting the parameters of such a discussion, of helping to decide what you should and should not say in such a context. And in fact, I would say that Christians have displayed a certain appreciation of dealing with a person who on independent grounds and for independent reasons has tried to gain an understanding of Christianity, even when the context is much more confrontational.
Okay. So as we finish up over here, first of all, I said earlier in the show that we'll get to different various things in Gemara, whatever, but it ran a bit long, so I don't think we're going to get to that. So for the listeners, Rich, maybe a different podcast. So first of all, I want to mention, I already mentioned Yosef Nitzach, there's two books that you published, like your collected writings with Academic Studies Press. Persecution, Polemic, and Dialogue is one, and then Culture and Collision and Conversation is another one. Maybe you want to talk about them just a little bit. And also, what other further suggested reading historically or, you know, in English, otherwise, that you would suggest for listeners interested in learning a little bit more about this topic?
Okay. So, I mean, you're inviting me to engage in a PR venture about my own books. So those two volumes are volumes of collected essays. The first one, which, as you said, is called Persecution, Polemic, and Dialogue, has a subtitle of Essays in Jewish-Christian Relations, which is a collection of what I've written about this subject. Not everything I've written about it is included, but it has two parts. One is historical, which includes my introduction to the edition of the Nitzachon Yashan, which the book was called The Jewish-Christian Debate in the High Middle Ages, which I know people still regard as one of the most useful introductions to that particular field. But it deals with quite a number of other issues, including some that you didn't talk about because of time, and Jewish martyrdom and whatnot. And the second part is it deals with contemporary, you know, modern and contemporary issues, where I express my personal opinions more directly about the Jewish-Christian dialogue and what it should entail, and Jewish formulations about Christianity that I do or do not like. There was, for example, something called Abru Emet that was issued by liberally oriented ecumenicists, a few of them Orthodox, a vast majority not. And I, you know, I have a reaction to that. I have a reaction to some papal and other modern Christian documents about Judaism. Maybe most interestingly, I have an article that was originally written for commentary on Mel Gibson's The Passion, which I got a letter from the New York Sun when it was still published as a paper, saying that they thought it was the best essay on this issue. And, you know, there was a whole brouhaha about that matter, as you well know. So that that's what that volume is. The other one is called Cultures in Collision and Conversation, Essays in the Intellectual History of the Jews. So there I have the largest essay is a almost, which is a monograph length essay. It came from a book called Judaism's Encounter with Other Cultures, which was edited by Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter as part of the YU Torah Mother Project. And it's a history of Jewish attitudes toward the legitimacy and study of subjects that are not Torah in the narrow sense. But there are many other essays there on Jewish messianism, for example, on the Ramban's view of miracles and his position during the Maimonidean controversy, and more. That's part one. In part two, I have two essays on the interpretation of the Bible. One that's called On the Morality of the Patriarchs in Medieval Jewish Polemic that contains a discussion of attitudes towards the problematic behavior of some important biblical personalities, for example, Yaakov's deception of his father. And I made an argument there near the end, which is not obviously connected with the topic, but is for the unity of the biblical narratives as against the views of biblical criticism. A second article in that section on Jewish commentators' views of the wisdom of Solomon, which is problematic wisdom in light of the mistakes that he made. And finally, the final section is about Jewish messianism that deals with a number of more modern, not necessarily modern, which deals with the topic of Jewish conceptions of the Messiah, going back to one of my first articles, the basis for the figure of Armilus, who is like a villainous final king of Edom, and Mashiach ben Yosef and the like, I also have a piece there which touches on another matter of contemporary interest for me. That could have been part of my answer to your earlier question about the relevance of all this. And that is an essay on why it is that, from my perspective at least, the Orthodox Jewish reaction to the belief that the Lubavitcher Rebbe is the Messiah even after his death has elicited so little vigorous a reaction in the Orthodox community. This is a whole other subject, but I will say that that my personal reaction to this development was so vigorous and so disturbed because of the fact that it seems to me, and still does, that this accepting this belief as a legitimate belief within Orthodox Judaism is a betrayal of generations of Jewish polemicists. who argued that this is an unacceptable belief in their interaction with Christians. And I would, I just want to make it clear that the way I would formulate this is that the belief in a messianic figure who declared that his generation would be the generation of the redemption, and who then dies in an unredeemed world, is a belief that no mainstream Jewish group had ever affirmed as valid. But this, of course, is a whole other subject.
Yes, that's a whole different subject we're not going to get into. You have obviously have a whole book published by Litman, the Library of Jewish Civilization, about that. I just want to mention about these two books that we just discussed. So first of all, the only drawback, the only problem with your books is that they are very expensive. They're only available for over $100, those two books, by Academic Studies Press. However, I did just look online, and the Cultures in Collision and Conversation one appears to be open access.
Indeed, yes.
So, which is terrific. So anybody can just go to Academic Studies Press website. I'll link to it in the I'll link to all the books in the show's description, and people can just read that book. It's open access. It's available for free, or if you want to pay the over $100. Sometimes there's sales, they have that type of thing.
I'm glad to hear that you say that this is the only thing wrong with these books.
I mean to say, while I'm talking to the author, even if I knew of something else, I wouldn't say it. I mean, that is something that is wrong with them, so to speak. I put in quotation marks.
Right.
Would there be any other books, though, on the, just to finish up, on the topic of Christian-Jewish polemic, not yours, other books that you would suggest people, as they're starting out, just wanting to learn a little bit more about this, that they should read?
Even though, I obviously don't want to suggest something other than my own books. But there is a very fine book by Daniel Lasker of Ben-Gurion University called Jewish Philosophical Polemics Against Christianity in the Middle Ages, which deals with what the title says it deals with. And it's really extremely well done. A number of works written. Well, let me see if I want to stay in the Middle Ages or in the classical period. There is not only Chazen's book that I mentioned earlier on the Barcelona Disputation, but he also wrote a fine book called Daggers of Faith about post-Barcelona missionary efforts by Christians in the late Middle Ages, which include the work of Raymond Martini, which was called Dagger of Faith, Pugio Fidei in Latin. Jews translated that as Pigiona Emuna, which was one of the most challenging anti-Jewish works provided and written by Christians in this period. There is a book, although it's not mainly about Klimat HaGoyim, but there's a book about Prophet Duran, who is a very interesting, problematic figure, by Maud Kazadoy. It has some material on Klimat HaGoyim. There are some works by Frank Talmadge, who edited some of these polemical works, and his essays are also collected. I don't remember the name of the work. What can I say? There are certainly works about contemporary Jewish-Christian relations, but that's not the primary issue that we have been dealing with.
I wanted to mention this one that I have. I know this one, the Talmud, the burning of the trial of the Talmud in Paris in 1240.
Yeah, well, that's actually a very good work. You're right. I'm glad you mentioned it.
So,
there's an essay, there's a historical essay there by Robert Chazen, which is actually very well done.
So I should mention that I haven't done this yet, and I don't know when I'm releasing all these, but I was in email contact with him to discuss his essay on this topic, and he said he would come on the podcast. So we'll see when that is to discuss this essay that he did in the book. It's a very nice, small book, like $20, and I don't know if you want to mention more about it.
Well, it provides a text of the disputation, and a translation, if I remember correctly, of the disputation, And it has this very valuable, almost short book length essay by Robert Chazin. We differ on one point where he has very good arguments. I still think it's probably not right that the burning of the Talmud and as a result of this disputation and the subsequent ban on Jewish books meant that there was a significant shortage of Sforim, of copies of the Talmud and other works in France in the second half, in the middle and second half of the 13th century. I think there's some reason to think that that's not so. I discussed this in two articles. Briefly, it's not the main point of the articles. But whatever that disagreement is, I think that this is a very, very fine piece of work.
Right. I should just say it has that article, and then there's two translations of the Latin account of the disputation right. and of the Hebrew account. So I'll link to all of this. So anyways, I think that's basically it. And thank you very much, Professor Berger, for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Okay. You're very welcome. Okay.